This is the One Thing Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Adam Rindy. The One Thing Podcast brings together leaders in functional and naturopathic medicine to discuss actionable information that may unlock puzzles in the areas of gut health, brain health, metabolism, and longevity. Please note, these episodes do not replace the opinion of your doctor. They are not intended to diagnose or treat any condition. Please discuss this information with your provider and discuss your own unique personal health history before adapting this information. Please subscribe to our episodes so that you can stay on top of the most current information in these areas of medicine. Thank you so much for joining this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome on Dr. Julie Barter, who currently practices in Whitefish, Montana, and she is a naturopathic physician with a deep experience in complex chronic illnesses such as Lyme disease, mycotoxin illness, and she also has treated over 1,000 COVID patients since the pandemic and has really developed a handle on long COVID. I said to her after our conversation that she's been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. She has seen it all during this pandemic experience, and it's really great to have her share with us the ins and outs and the nuances of someone who actually took the information we were learning about COVID and applied it to help her patients get better. So we go into things like hypercoagulation disorders related to long COVID. We talk about the bystander co-infections that get activated in some patients. We talk about all the various treatments and labs that are detecting some of the inner workings of long COVID, such as cytokine panels, and also looking at advanced treatment ideas and strategies that have helped her patients, and all the things that she learned during this process. This is a full circle conversation since we started doing podcasts on COVID, and this sort of brought things all together so that we can take this experience and move forward and treat people who are still getting COVID, but also to apply this information to help people who are struggling with long COVID. And then for future things that we're dealing with, to have a framework of a wide variety of pathophysiology, meaning a wide variety of understanding how the body is responding to viral illness. We now have much more information, and I'm sure you'll agree with me that Dr. Barter has really a great handle on this topic matter. So without further ado, I welcome you to the next episode of the One Thing Podcast. Dr. Barter, welcome to the One Thing Podcast. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I am excited to speak to a fellow naturopathic physician about a topic that, you know, today is August 4th, 2023. And so we really, you know, started really getting into thinking about the sequelae or the long COVID concept around this time 3 years ago, because, you know, that was really when we started to see that, hey, this isn't a condition that necessarily just goes away after you get the infection. So it's great to have 3 years under our belt to continue to have this conversation. Before getting into that, I'd just love to hear your unique background. You have quite a interesting story about, you know, what you did before you became a naturopathic physician. And I'd love to have you share with the audience like how that transition came about from your previous work deciding to go into naturopathic medicine.
Sure. So I started out just in life, just wanting to race my bike. So I was really happy to get out of doing time in Texas, where I attended Texas A&M as a biochemistry major. I didn't know it was pre-med at that time, and moved to Boulder, Colorado, just mostly so I could race my bicycles, you know, mountain bike, road bikes. But I got a job in a lab, a neuroscience lab, because of my biochemistry background. And they focused on the mechanisms of chronic pain and inflammation. So I wasn't doing any of the fancy footwork there. I was just a lab tech. And then later I managed the lab, but it did give me a lot of exposure to science and how it's done. And I quickly realized, well, not so quickly, I was a little slow on the uptake, that research was not at all where my heart was. And I was suffering with chronic illness myself, which at that time I had no idea was chronic Lyme disease. And it was actually a chiropractor was the first one to ask me what I was eating, what I was doing to get me back on track. And this was after seeing the entire health system at UC Health, 30, 40, 50 physicians I saw trying to explain what was going on with me. So that inspired me, like, wow, hey, this whole medical system, all these brilliant minds at National Jewish and UC Health, and nobody could figure out what was going on with me, and nobody did until quite a bit later. But at least this chiropractor got me on the right track. He'd given me some adrenal support and getting me on the good diet and some better lifestyle habits, and that set me off to NUNM. So completed naturopathic medical school there, attended the chiropractic school as well, love physical medicine. And then I was off to practice in Maine, which is, you know, a Lyme hotbed, as you know. Was there for a couple years doing just basic primary care stuff. And the doc I took over from said, oh, she was on the phone, literally on the way out of town. You'll see a lot of Lyme patients. Run Igenex, treat them with herbs, antibiotics, whatever you want. They'll get better. And they did. And then I moved to Colorado and I thought, ah, there's no Lyme here. And failing on a lot of patients doing all the usual stuff. And so I scratched my head and said, gosh, why are all the things that usually work so beautifully in the naturopathic world failing on these people? Maybe I better run a Lyme test. And sure enough, so I got a practice full of Lyme patients. And then I went, oh, now I have a practice full of Lyme patients. Maybe I better learn how to actually treat this thing. So I joined ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, and got proper training and mentored with one of their docs for over 400 hours. I spent in his office seeing patients with him, an internist, Dan Kinderlayer. So I got a good training there from him on all the subtleties of treating really complex infection. And as it turns out, as luck would have it, when COVID came around, the principles that were applicable to treating chronic Lyme wound up being identical to what we do to treat long COVID. So that's the nutshell of how I got to treating long COVID. It was like, wow, this is already my jam. I totally know how to do this.
It is thought that the pathogenesis of long COVID is related to many factors, including the possibility that after the COVID infection, there are persistent viral reservoirs that are setting up in tissue that contain the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Studies by Klein in 2022 discussed that there are reservoirs possible in the respiratory tract, GI tract, heart, and brain that persist beyond the acute phase of infection, and these are linked to patients who have long COVID. Another mechanism of what happens in long COVID patients is persistent immune activation, meaning that the immune cells stay upregulated long after the initial COVID infection, meaning that the immune system's dysregulated and there's chronic inflammation and tissue damage and persistence of the symptoms. Or there has been a link to endothelial dysfunction, including blood abnormalities, microclotting, dysfunction in the endothelial tissue, the vessels that can take place in long COVID patients, which affects impaired blood flow and oxygen delivery to various tissues. And this can contribute to symptoms such as fatigue and cognitive dysfunction. Finally, we see long COVID patients sometimes experiencing autonomic nervous system dysfunction, which can present as dysregulation of heart rate variability, balance issues such as orthostatic intolerance, GI disturbances such as poor motility, and these can be related to the behind-the-scene nervous system called the autonomic nervous system, where the initial and persistent impact of COVID-19 is affecting the vagus nerve and other regulatory systems that control the autonomic nervous system.
And how early in the COVID process did you realize that?
So COVID blew through our office the first, well, the very last week of January into the first week of February of 2020. One of our docs brought it home from a long layover in Seattle before they closed the China travel. And it took us about 3 weeks to figure out, like, oh, we all just had COVID. And so we started seeing, well, long before we had any testing to prove that that was COVID, that it was everywhere. And so we figured out the early treatment thing right away. And we can talk about that if you want, or if that's boring and old hat at this point, we can skip that.
Well, I think what'd be interesting about that is just like how you pivoted when in those early days, like, was it like, oh, well, this is just your everyday virus, or this one's different and we need to do things differently than we would typically do? Like, what was that moment like?
That was pretty much right away. It was, you know, really clear. This virus is a killer. And I knew that. I was watching it. I was watching the news from China and medical feeds about the virus before it ever hit the United States. You know, so back in November and December of 19, I was watching the news from China going, this is a nasty one. This is probably the next big one. And it's a killer. So I knew that before it even hit here. And when it hit here, I was doing, I would say, very basic treatments. I was using a lot of herbals, you know, just classic naturopathic cough herbals that happened to work great on the cough, but weren't enough for the real respiratory distress patients. So in those patients, I started using either azithromycin or doxycycline and hydroxychloroquine right away. And it worked really well. And I was also using steroids early on, higher dose steroids early on, especially in the severe respiratory distress cases. And that worked very well. We did not have anybody wind up in the hospital who did those things of the many, many, many people that I treated. I don't think anybody wound up in the hospital. So that's kind of how I went along for those first, until about September or October, when I stumbled upon a bunch of stuff published by the FLCCC, the frontline, whatever their acronym is now, before enough past that I've forgotten what the acronym is. But I stumbled on their published research on ivermectin, and I went, wow, this is a drug I use all the time in my Lyme population for treating babesiosis. I'm completely comfortable with this med. I've used it a lot. It's dirt cheap. Like, it's everywhere. This is great. And so I never looked back. I started prescribing ivermectin to everybody, and it worked way better than antibiotics and the hydroxychloroquine. So then it progressed to using ivermectin and antibiotics and hydroxychloroquine plus the herbals and, you know, all the stuff, the vitamin C, the vitamin D, the quercetin, the zinc, the so on and so forth that everybody knows about now. And that worked great. And that kept me really busy. I was sometimes dozens of patients a day using that stuff. And then we started to see the, you know, the people who never bounce back from the respiratory distress, or who went into heart failure or get a severe neurological syndrome, or they're just crushed with fatigue, or their O2 sats stay in the 80s and, you know, after they're released. So in those folks, I started using oxygen, heparin, you know, all the blood pressure meds, heart meds and stuff, to, if they were in heart failure or develop POTS, things like that. A lot of high dose steroids as well to help those folks.
So it'd be interesting to hear like the setting and the that you're practicing in, population that you're serving, just to kind of conceptualize, you know, kind of what you were faced with and the people you've been taking care of. Because that's, you are doing all the things that, you know, even in an ICU or critical care setting that you might see pop up from time to time. What is your setting like?
So I'm in an integrative setting. We've traditionally had at least one naturopathic doctor, if not more, and either a medical doctor or an advanced practice nurse practitioner. So it is an integrative setting that if something's not technically within my scope of practice, that there's somebody else here who says, oh yes, we're doing this. This is what we're doing. So it allowed me really full privilege to do whatever needed to be done in the outpatient setting only. So we're serving a patient population. We're in Northwest Montana. It's pretty remote. The hospital system is inaccessible for a lot of people who live hours and hours from the hospital. So we treated a great many people. We've got a lot of Amish populations, things of that nature, who live in very remote areas with very little access to medical care. So we treated thousands of them via telemedicine and, you know, just regular average people. Everything from kids, most of whom really didn't get very sick, to the older patient populations, especially the people 60 and over, were really hit hard. And then some in their 40s and 50s were hit pretty hard as well, but mostly that 60 and up were the folks that were in a lot of trouble.
Long COVID is described as COVID-19 related symptoms that last over 28 days post initial infection and can last many months longer than that. The symptoms are generally fatigue, shortness of breath, impaired concentration, memory problems, loss of taste and smell, and just overall general cognitive dysfunction. Those are the most common symptoms that we see with long COVID. It's estimated that 42.5% to 52% of those who experienced COVID-19 will go along to have long COVID. That data depends on whatever subgroup were being studied, but was found that through Bloomberg in 2021 that 52% of young adults aged 16 to 30 who were isolated with mild COVID-19 had symptoms at 6 months.
So, you know, the estimates are that 40 to 50% of people that get COVID will go on to get sequelae of COVID or long COVID or long haulers. Would you say that was your experience, or did you see less or more than that?
I would say that in the people who treated aggressively, that I didn't see very much long haul. Maybe 20% of those people, if we got them early treatment and aggressive treatment, and they continued, particularly the steroids. I found the steroids the most helpful thing that helped people recover the most quickly. And, you know, I did use a lot of prednisone, methylprednisolone, but also a lot of hydrocortisone, you know, at physiologic doses, meaning doses that we would give a normal person just to support adrenal function and normal energy levels, rather than the, you know, the immunosuppressive doses that we give when people are really desperately ill or in the hospital, that type of thing. So the folks who did the aggressive early treatment mostly got better pretty quickly, but I would agree, you know, 30 to 50% of the people who are not treated early enough or not aggressively enough go on to get long haul. Totally agree with that.
The etiology and risk factors for long COVID has been a subject of ongoing study. One interesting finding by Haran in 2021 showed that a prevalence of Prevotella and Villanella species in the oral microbiome was related to long COVID risk. Also, pre-existing health conditions such as poor pre-pandemic mental health, poor general health, asthma, being overweight or obese are other risk factors for long COVID, according to Thompson in 2021. Makes sense because these factors may contribute to general inflammation and immune response leading up to a COVID infection. And one of the theories also that is not as well defined is the presence of bystander infections that may be present in long COVID patients, such as people with previous Epstein-Barr virus concerns, cytomegalovirus concerns, and perhaps mold and mycotoxin illness.
Okay. And then in your population of people that you saw, what was some of the conditions that people had or predisposing risk factors people had that might have led them to get COVID, long COVID, over not getting it? Or was there really no pattern?
Oh, I would say that there are patterns. You know, we all know about the, you know, they're the boring things we all know about: diabetes, obesity, pre-existing heart disease, pre-existing autoimmune condition, less talked about vitamin D deficiency. You know, we're going to start talking about vitamins, then we get into the weird world of mainstream medicine, not really recognizing that stuff, even though it seems pretty obvious at this point. And I would say that the one gem that I really came away from this whole COVID thing that I really did not have a good understanding of before in medicine is clotting disorders. So it turns out that the people with clotting disorders, you know, you don't think about clotting disorders in young people, like young women or even middle-aged women. You'd never think about that this person might have a clotting disorder till they have their first stroke in their 80s or something. But it seems you do the Intellix DNA genomics testing, right? I happen to have like a nice big catalog of genomics data on a lot of the people that I got to work with. And it turned out that a lot of the people who had a lot more problems than I expected with COVID were the ones with clotting disorders. So I figured out pretty early in that whole, you know, treatment of acute COVID, I love heparin. Really like heparin. Really, you know, aspirin's not a fibrinolytic, but it, meaning it doesn't break down fibrin clots, but it prevents platelets from sticking together, which is helpful. So I started using the fibrinolytics early on, especially heparin was an absolute winner. So that turned the corner for a lot of those people with O2 sats down in the 80s, steroids and heparin injections. And they would, I wish I had a dollar for every time somebody left the office and within 5 minutes of a heparin injection called me from the car and said, I can't believe it. I can breathe for the first time.
Wow.
Whiffs.
Diagnosis and assessment of long COVID is still rather nebulous, relying on symptom reports, questionnaires, and general history taking. There is no confirmed diagnostic test for assessing long COVID. It's currently dependent on symptom reporting from the patient and the interpretation of that by the clinician to receive a diagnosis of long COVID. The common symptoms will guide the clinician as well as the timing of these symptoms. It's very important to know if the symptoms such as impaired concentration, memory problems, loss of taste and smell, cough, headache, etc., preceded getting COVID or new symptoms that were taken on after receiving COVID.
Amazing. Yeah, that's interesting. And when you're sitting with your patients and we kind of think about what's happening in the long COVID patient, how are you picking up on what their need is? Is it things like lung saturation, or are you checking circulation through pulse measurements or through palpation? How are you just getting that early data that someone might need some help with their clotting pathways?
Well, most people got a pulse oximeter, you know, the thing you put on your finger and it measures your heart rate and your pulse. So most people had one of those at home to work with during COVID. And I would just take that information on the phone. What is your O2 reading say right now? And what does it say after your oxygen treatment? What does it say after your steroid nebulizer treatment? What does it say after your heparin injection? How long does it stay that way? And so we would set treatment times based on when the O2 levels would drop again. And in terms of clotting disorders, you really only know about that if you check blood markers. So I've wound up getting a crash course in all the coagulation markers and running a lot of those. And I've been astounded. Almost everybody who gets a long COVID problem winds up showing us evidence of microclots. And, you know, sometimes we'll find the clots where we can see them on a CT of the lungs and so forth. But we had a lot of patients who didn't have any abnormalities on lung imaging. But when we draw the blood, we go, oh my gosh, you're just full of microclots. It's amazing you haven't dropped dead yet. And those people have had great responses to the anticoagulation therapies.
So can you go into that a little bit more? I'm really curious about that because I've personally hunted around for evidence of microclots with my long COVID patients and have not really had great luck finding it on testing, but I know you've done much more than I have and have additional training in that. So I'd love to hear, like, how are you doing that? I mean, is it from specific clotting pathway panels? Is it from looking under a slide? How is that done?
Yeah, just lab work. The typical stuff that, you know, if you just have to check a box on the hospital lab rec, a DIC panel, you know, disseminated intravascular coagulation. If you only have access to a hospital lab, that's the first go-to. And then if you get to use LabCorp or Quest or something like that, you can pick all the markers that you want to. So D-dimer, if I could only pick one, I could only have one, it would be D-dimer, but also fibrin degradation, breakdown products. So evidence of the breakdown of those microclots, thrombin, antithrombin complex. I'm running PT-INR and often finding like, oh boy, these people are, their blood is running like ketchup instead of red wine. This is not good. So if you want a link to one of those panels, the DIC Comprehensive Plus has almost all that stuff within it. If you just want to check a box on the LabCorp requisition form.
Mm-hmm.
So totally standard stuff with quick turnaround times that you can act on quickly.
Yeah. And do you see those levels self-resolve the further away from acute infection, or is it with the long hauler population, is it sort of just kind of sustained?
They do not self-resolve is what I'm often finding, that people will come in months after COVID where they're like, oh, I kind of thought I got over it, but I'm still really tired, or my brain still doesn't work at all, or I'm still not sleeping right, or I still have all this weird pain stuff. The shortness of breath, heaviness on the chest, weird heart stuff has been really common. I'm finding D-dimers that are alarming and other, you know, markers of coagulation that are downright alarming in the outpatient setting months after they've thought that the acute COVID has resolved. And I'm finding that those don't self-resolve. So I'm giving blood thinners for weeks to months, and then I just track whatever clotting markers were abnormal until they're back to normal. And then maybe I'll spot check after that once they've resolved to just make sure they stay resolved, which often they do and sometimes they don't.
Okay. And so when you get people started on these improvements of or reduction of microclotting and improve blood parameters, what are you seeing the outcomes are? Like, what do people experience? Do they come back telling you they feel different, or is it just sort of part of a biomarker that you're balancing, or are you actually like seeing the reduction of symptoms?
I would say that the reduction of symptoms that the patient experiences just goes right step by step, hand in hand, along with the improvements that we see in the lab parameters, which are, as I said, those coagulation markers, the markers of inflammation. And we can get into those because I've got a few favorites to talk about there.
Yeah, too. I've got some questions about that.
I bet you do. But I would say that the symptom resolution just marches, you know, right hand in hand with the resolution of the markers in the blood.
So like the classic long COVID symptoms like brain fog, fatigue, loss of smell, loss of taste, and dizziness and all those things, is that where you're talking about, that cluster?
Yeah, that's part of it. And also the biomarkers that I really like to test to try to have a target to go after with a targeted treatment. You know, instead of shooting in the dark and saying, let's give you, 10 herbs and 4 medications, I like to figure out where the problem is in the inflammatory cascade or the immune system and go after something. Like, I like to have a target and then something I could track on.
Yeah, that's great. And, I know part of what we're thinking about with long COVID is, this microcoagulation disorders. And then there's some research that's talking about like chronic immune activation, which you were just talking about. What are you seeing with that? Like, what's activated? Like, is it a certain cytokine trend? For those people that are not familiar with the word cytokine, like basically there's anything you can do to break that down and make it simple for us.
Sure. So a cytokine is basically a chemical signaling. It's a molecule that's released from a white blood cell or from an organ to signal other white blood cells or other tissues nearby to do something, to, hey, throw out some histamine, throw out some hydrogen peroxide bombs, tell that other white blood cell to be quiet over there, tell the whole immune system that we have a 5-alarm fire. So the cytokines are basically a communication system, kind of like tweeting or something like that.
Text messaging.
They're like text messages. So I want to give a special shout out to Dr. Patterson for the work that he put out with a group of, he had a pool of, I think, upwards of 10,000 patients that he measured all these cytokines on. I can't remember which big teaching hospital he was affiliated with, but he had a great data collection system, and he was able to measure, to define a set of cytokines and chemokines and fractal kinds that he could actually measure in the blood. And so he was able to identify patterns of elevations of these cytokines that would drive certain long-haul symptom clusters, which was brilliant. I was just sitting there at this presentation he gave at the autoimmune encephalopathy secondary to infectious disease. Whew, that's a mouthful. I was sitting there with my mouth hanging open watching this presentation, because he's got this beautiful graph of all the cytokines that are driving these long-haul symptoms and which cytokines are driving which symptom clusters, like neurological symptoms, he found that VEGF was consistently elevated and that soluble CD40 ligand was also likewise elevated. Shortness of breath, IL-2, TNF-alpha, GM-CSFs, soluble CD40 ligand. So he developed these, you know, clusters of cytokines that go with these particular symptoms. Oh, you can't smell. That's these cytokines. Oh, it's fatigue. It's these things. And then he gave us the drugs that work on these things, which is just great. So once I had that, I was like, okay, what do you have? Let me look at my graph. Yes. Okay, we're going to give you ivermectin. We're going to give you prednisone. We're going to give you a statin. We're going to give you propranolol. It really educated us how to be very targeted with treatments on those long-haul symptom pictures. So just brilliant work by Dr. Patterson.
Yeah, it's great. And having this conversation a lot, and this is sort of a little off kind of what you just shared with me. And I had this conversation with, I think, your colleagues with Dr. Pimentel as well. But you were saying that sometimes, like in this situation that you're in and I'm in, things don't just initially just jump out on a lab panel in this kind of neat pattern. And, you know, it's like maybe on the edge, maybe elevated, kind of not necessarily clearly positive. It's what we call equivocal. And so we're seeing with certain people where, you know, the practitioner and the patient just have to kind of make a call that this is likely taking place and to proceed with treatment. What is that like for you when you're kind of in those situations where it's not clear cut what's going on? It's sort of high normal or not in that kind of clear high or low space?
Well, it's nice to have options in that case and to understand both the meds, the herbs, the natural stuff, and to just talk with the patient and say, hey, here are the options. Here are some medication options. The risks are this. Like, if this is not actually what we're treating, here are the risks that go along with that medication. Is that worth the risk to possible benefit ratio? Or do we want to stay with something that is, you know, you're a lot less likely to hurt yourself with herbals or nutrients or things of that sort? So everything I've said about all of the many medications I've used during this whole process, underlying that is the supposition that I'm already supporting these people with all of the immune supporting nutrients and using the herbals in any of the cases where it's possible when people have access to them. So in those cases where I'm in doubt, I'll stick with things that I feel are safer, like herbs and nutrients. But if I have a big target to go after, like a very, very scary IL-4 or a very scary D-dimer, I'm going to go for the big guns.
I love that. That's great. Yeah, it's one of the benefits of being trained as an integrative provider is to just to have that wide tool chest to be able to offer. With these panels, is there special handling? Is there difficulty getting coverage? What's it like for the everyday person who's maybe, like, you know, got insurance, but they don't have a lot of disposable income to spend on a lot of labs?
Yeah. So we have a lot of uninsured or underinsured people. And for those folks, that's pretty difficult. So in those cases, you just kind of go, okay, we're operating with an insufficiency of information and we're going to do what we think is safe and appropriate. But for most people with insurance, those clotting panels are covered with appropriate coding, which is not too difficult to figure out. The cytokine panels are more expensive. People have to have better insurance coverage for those. So for instance, is it Diagnostex? There is a company, oh gosh, you could find that thread on the Intellix DNA. There's a company that offers that cytokine panel at a reasonable price, like $300 or something like that, that a mere mortal can afford, but it takes weeks to come back, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think, yeah, it's good to know. And, you know, sometimes also knowing the patterns just by the big body of research that Dr. Patterson has put together, knowing the patterns gives you at least a framework of a starting point on some of these patients of, you know, that it's most likely this kind of cytokine pattern and these are the tools we have for that.
Right. Yeah. And then also just having a huge body of patients to work from, going, okay, I've done this thousands of times now. When we have this symptom, these are the meds or the things that tend to help resolve that. And I'll just say this will be a good, I'm going to use the I word, that ivermectin has just saved thousands of lives. I'm probably sticking my neck out, putting a target on my back, but I'm pretty sure it saved thousands of lives up here in this area that I'm practicing. And if I can only have one thing for an acute COVID patient, meaning somebody who's sick right this second, or somebody who's suffering with long haul, no question, hands down, ivermectin to the rescue. If I could only have one thing on a desert island, that would be it.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, I think the more and more that, I guess, the mainstream is studying the mechanism, it makes a whole lot of sense when you understand how it's working.
Yeah, it lowers IL-4, which IL-4, interleukin-4, is an inflammatory cytokine that tells white blood cells to tell each other to release histamine. And that is one of the really weird things about this bug that I would love to touch on, besides the clotting disorder thing. You know, like, that's really weird for a virus to cause a clotting disorder. Like, Ebola does that, but that's one of the unique things about COVID is that not very many viruses set off the clotting cascade like this. And likewise, not very many viruses, or I can't think of any off the top of my head readily, that just drive IL-4 through the roof. And that is the most consistent finding that I found on blood work when I run the cytokine panels that I've had easy access to, meaning not Dr. Patterson's panel that's been harder to access. I found astounding IL-4s on patients and then astounding histamine levels. And we see all that stuff that goes with histamine, you know, like hivey kinds of reactions and itching and swelling and fluid in the wrong places and extreme reactivity to things. And the antihistamines work great on that. And then ivermectin also happens to do a great job lowering IL-4. So it's perfectly suited to that just uniqueness of this microbe.
Yeah, that's great. And we think that one of these lessons that's only going to help us navigate future viruses that come our way and, you know, pandemic scenarios is just all this amazing things that we've learned during this process. Unfortunately, we've lost so many people too, but I think we've just learned so much. The other cytokine that really, for me, was eye-opening was TNF-alpha and learning that connection to brain fog.
Yep, maybe amen to that. Sure. It's one of those few. There are only a few cytokines that are known to really readily penetrate the blood-brain barrier, meaning most things only operate from the neck down and the brain is very protected and the brain does not allow those inflammatory signalers into the brain. And one is IL-1 alpha and the other one is TNF alpha. And that TNF alpha is a king of brain fog cytokines. So I love lion's mane for that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great that, you know, sort of these things are going to just, like I said, help us moving forward. And we're still seeing long COVID, so we still have to apply this information. Pivoting a little bit to talking about other subsets of the long COVID patient, there's this group of people that we think are more at risk for long COVID because they have these co-infections or dormant past infections that are ready to be rear their head again. And so I love the analogy of, like, you know, a classroom of infections just kind of sitting there behaving, and then COVID comes around and all heck breaks loose. So can you talk a little bit more about your experience with that? You know, with this is your jam. I mean, these co-infections, Lyme, EBV, can you talk more about what you saw and are seeing in COVID and in populations that maybe have these hanging around? What happens?
Sure. Well, number one, a lot of people are very familiar with Epstein-Barr and cytomegalovirus as the viruses that cause mononucleosis and can cause chronic fatigue syndrome, even, you know, many, many years or decades after people have had mono, even if they didn't know that they had it. So I actually did a little chuckle when you sent me those two papers to look at, because I have an ongoing debate with an old internist friend of mine. He's in his mid-70s. And so we've had a lot of very lively debates about actual viral reactivation, which he doesn't believe occurs. So I'm going to forward those papers on to my good friend David Luce and say, oh gosh, look at this published research about the reactivation of these of Epstein-Barr and cytomegalovirus. So I had a little chuckle when you sent me those papers, because that's the first time I've actually seen published medical literature on that actually occurring, although I've been acting as though that's exactly what's going on for years. So coming back to your question, yeah, I've seen many patients have a relapse of Epstein-Barr or any of that herpes virus. There are many, many, many members of that family. So, you know, cold sores, genital herpes, fatigue viruses like human herpes virus 6, EBV, they just come crashing right back. And those are DNA viruses, so you have to treat them a little bit differently than the COVID itself. So those folks, they just got to undergo all those treatments that they did before for Epstein-Barr antivirals of various sorts, whether it's medications or herbs or things like Monolaurin is probably my favorite for those. And then I can't tell you how many Lyme patients that I have who were either in remission or like kind of shaky or not good at all, who completely crashed and burned. And a lot of my Lyme patients took 6 to 9 months to climb back out of the hole after getting COVID and required retreatment for things that they had not required treatment for at that time. So a lot of crashes of people who suffered with, you know, a lot of things. Well, I was okay with the mold exposure I was getting at, you know, at work until I got COVID, and then I'm just, you know, wrecked by the mold again. So anything that people struggled with in the past could kind of come back and reactivate because they were so weakened, their systems were so depleted by COVID.
And in those situations, were you going through like retesting, reevaluation of these scenarios, or just based on the fact that you knew the patients, you knew their patterns and their symptoms kind of reappeared, you just conclude that they've had a relapse or a recurrence?
No, a lot of times it wasn't obvious. We'd have to go digging for like, what the heck is going on here? We're treating you for long COVID and you're just not improving at all. We've got to go on a little detective mission here and run a bunch of blood tests and just find out, is it a virus that's acting up? Does it look like an inflammatory profile that's more suggestive that this is a Lyme reactivation? So yeah, sometimes it was obvious, but a lot of times it was not.
Yeah. I would agree with that. I had similar experiences throughout this with many of my patients. And so it became, you know, a very complex puzzle to kind of tease out what's going on. But yeah, and, you know, I'd say like on more of an optimistic view of today, like how are you feeling about where we're at now? Do you feel like we have the tools we need to kind of move forward with SARS-CoV-2 being in our population and, you know, kind of the worst is behind us, or do you still like, or feel we're still dealing with mystery here?
Well, with the strains of Omicron that have been going around the last year and a half to 2 years, I feel pretty comfortable. I've not seen those causing nearly as much long haul as the Delta. The Delta was terrifying. Delta was absolutely terrifying. For Delta, I was routinely deploying 4 to 6 heavy-duty medications at a time to the high-risk patients, you know, daily. With Omicron, now I think those of us who are at least open-minded and decided to go ahead and work in the trenches during COVID, to those of us who did that, it's totally obvious after thousands, and I did count, so I'm not exaggerating, thousands of COVID patients, it's absolutely treatable if you catch it in the early stages for the vast majority of people, if you catch it early. And now the Omicron, much milder, much less terrifying. We still have early treatments that work and then far less long haul coming out of those. So I'm seeing that, you know, the IV suite is not full of these people who are requiring rescue bailouts anymore, or not a lot less often. And then we know what works on this thing now.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, this has been really, really helpful and just great to hear someone who's kind of weaved in years of treating environmental illness and infectious disease and applying it to this phenomena that we had and kind of walking away with even deeper understanding. So thank you for sharing your experience with us. It's really been enlightening, and I'd love to hear more about what you're up to with your practice or anything that you'd like to tell us about and how people can follow your work and get involved with perhaps working with you and learning from you.
Oh, thank you. So yeah, mostly the vast majority of my patient population is Lyme disease. So, you know, treating tick bites, which is what I was doing right before I got on here as a 7-year-old girl with a tick bite who got some decent early treatment, but developed a movement disorder anyway, that was pretty scary to look at. So working with that, mostly chronic Lyme patients, and feel passionate about getting information out to people where they can access things. And then go, you know, find a provider that will help them with things that may not be accessible through their primary care physician or insurance-based system, but might be. So I have a wealth of information on my website, nfmedicine.com. You can put that in the show notes if you like. So I have a lot of the treatments that we've been using for both people who are sick with COVID at the moment, as well as long COVID treatments. And some of the other more advanced treatments we've not had time to talk about on here are posted on my website, because I want people to know what are we doing that we think works, you know, IVs and other more advanced things. And the same is true for the Lyme patients. I've just got a huge body of information about how to test for it, how to treat it, what the co-infections look like. That's all up on my website. So a lot of my colleagues are publishing books, and I figure, well, it's easy for me to put it on my website and a lot less trouble than writing a book. So
yeah,
it's all just up on the internet.
Keep it up to date.
Yeah.
You can update it easily. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, I can tell you're very courageous as a doctor, but also very safe and measured in your approach. So the world needs doctors like you, especially in really complex situations. It takes all that. So thank you for doing the work you do. And thanks for sharing with us today. And I'd love to keep in touch down the road and revisit more topics with you.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
All right. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. Please share these episodes with your friends, loved ones, colleagues, patients, healthcare providers, anyone who you feel might benefit from hearing these informative interviews. We tend to learn best from people sharing things with us. That's often the first time it's introduced. So don't hesitate if the content of these episodes reminded you of someone that might benefit from it. Forward the episode to them, and I'm sure they'll either appreciate it or be appreciative that you've thought of them. So once again, we'll look forward to seeing you next episode on the One Thing Podcast. And again, much appreciation for you being here with me.